Welcome to Books, Stories, People with me, Nancy Richards. Relative to some other countries, there are really very few golfers in South Africa. And yet, according to sports journalist Dan Retief, this country punches way above its weight in terms of winning players, with four of them inducted into the World Golf Hall of Fame, including one of South Africa's best-known players of all time, Gary Player. In honour of Player's 85th birthday in November 2020, editor, publisher and writer in this case, Retief released a book that takes in all the feats, failures, fables and foibles of the pros who've put South Africa at the forefront of world golf. It's called The Sunshine Boys, the epic story of how South Africa's golfers conquered the world. It's the official publication of the fabled Sunshine Tour. Well, golf in South Africa, as we know, is not all sunshine and light. But first, I asked Dan to explain the title.
Well, there has to be a disclaimer to start with, because, of course, Neil Simon wrote a play called The Sunshine Boys, which is very famous. And if you were to Google it, guess what comes up? But I just thought the golf tour became the Sunshine Tour. It was called The Sunshine Tour. And The Sunshine Boys was such a sort of apt name for the guys who play golf. And there have been so many characters. So the Sunshine Boys was a good fit. And it was better than The Sunshine Tour. And then, funny enough, I was worried about the gender specific title, but I checked with the Sunshine Girls and from Sally Little Down, who also, you know, we have some outstanding lady golfers, and they were happy with the Sunshine Boys. You know, they say they referred to themselves as Sunshine Boys. So that's where it came from. Sunshine, happy, naughty, that kind of thing.
So it's got a good provenance. But the Sunshine Tour itself, it's obviously been established for a long time. What's its background and what's its present status?
Yeah, the Sunshine Tour is actually relatively new, because golf came to South Africa via the military, via the British military. Obviously, the Scots and the English brought battered old clubs over when the armies came out, started playing on the Green Market area. It wasn't suited for golf. There was a bit of golf played at the Wynberg camp. And then eventually they settled on the Rondebosch Common, where there was a golf course. And that is where Royal Cape, South Africa's oldest club, first came from. When they realized that the Rondebosch Common didn't work very well because there were cows grazing and it got full of water, they moved to Ottery and established a club, and that became Royal Cape. And so that's our oldest club. Then for many years, there was a South African Open run by amateurs for everybody. And then there was tournaments run by Western Province, Transvaal, Natal, open tournaments, which the pros could play in. But then in around about 1969, they decided that maybe it was time the pros ran their own tournaments. And a man called Brian Henning, who was based at King David, which is now no longer, was asked to run a tournament. That was his first. And he just hit on the name, the Sunshine Tour, or as it was then known, the Sunshine Circuit. And funny enough, they played from the last 2 days of 1969 into the first 2 days of 1970. So they actually played on Old Year's Eve and on New Year's Day, which I think modern people don't do. He just said that he thought sunshine was perfect because a lot of young British players came out and they came for our sunshine because they were caught in snow and blizzards and awful weather. And so the sunshine stuck. It changed names a few times. But finally, sunshine was so perfect for golf in South Africa that it is now called the Sunshine Tour and hence the Sunshine Boys.
So it's ongoing.
Oh, yes, absolutely. It's a very strong circuit. It's well supported by South African players and by foreign players. It's really become a development tour for the USPGA Tour and for the European Tour. There are some other tours as well in Japan and Asia, and Australia. They have sort of circuits of tournaments. But people love coming to South Africa. There are many very famous players who cut their teeth in South Africa, maybe won a tournament here or learnt what their trade was or how to win and came out here. So, for instance, Nick Felder first won in South Africa because he was looking for a place to play. And ironically, it's in the book, which probably most people forget, Tony Jacklin, who captained Ryder Cup teams, who became one of Britain's greatest golfing characters. He won his first tournament in Kimberley, also looking for a place to play, to practice his craft. And it was called the Kimberley 4000 in 1966 because De Beers put up a prize fund of 4,000 rand, and Tony Jacklin Declan won that tournament in quite sort of odd circumstances, because Harold Henning was meant to be there for a playoff, but he thought he'd won and left to catch his plane, and then ended in a tie. So they awarded it to Sir Tony Declan.
Lots and lots of stories, eh? And I'm just thinking that if South Africa was such a popular destination amongst international golfers, how badly COVID-19 must have affected the whole golfing industry. But before you answer that question, which is another story, the Sunshine Tour, so you've given us a little bit of a background and how long golf has been in South Africa, but what's the status of it now? I can't remember. I did read the figure of how many golf clubs we have, how many golfers we have, and it's a very small number of golfers, but just give us an indication of the size of golf in the country.
The precis of the book is that we are probably the best golfing nation in the world, or certainly the best little golfing country, because we have relatively few golfers, and our position on the globe, the very bottom end of Africa. So our trailblazers would have to go by boat and go a long way to be successful at golf. And we've done exceptionally as a golf nation. Golf is a game that is under pressure at the moment, and they're two distinct parts of golf. There's the amateurs who play on Saturdays and weekdays at their clubs and form clubs, and that's the amateur side. And then there's the professionals who want to earn money from playing golf. And funny enough, they break into two groups as well, because there you can be a professional golfer or a golf professional. Now, a professional golfer is somebody who makes his money from playing golf, and a golf professional is somebody who might run a shop, give lessons. So it's two branches of the same thing. But we have about 450,000 golfers, and a very small percentage of them are outstanding players, although we have many. But when I say the game is under pressure, the game is extremely expensive. It is an elitist game, you know, because you need certain wherewithal to be able to be a golfer. Golf courses are very expensive to maintain. Golf equipment is extremely expensive now, especially that most of it comes from, well, there's virtually none manufactured in South Africa. So you're paying against the dollar, you're paying against the yen for your equipment. So that already puts a bar on golf. So all over the world now, you're seeing golf courses reducing their land, becoming par three golf courses, so people can play a quick round in an hour and a half. The other big drawback of golf is that it takes so long to play. And in the modern world, people don't like to give up a whole day to play a sport. So it is a game under pressure. But funny enough, the professional game is as healthy as it's ever been. You know, all the tours work. They've all got prize funds. They've managed to stage tournaments in the time of the pandemic. We've just, in South Africa, staged three tournaments in a bio bubble, kept everybody safe, moved 350 people from Johannesburg to Leopard Creek to Sun City. So the professional game is strong and healthy. And one good thing of the professional game, which was actually came down from the Americans, is that it has a big charity aspect. So every tournament, the funds raised and during the tournaments, there are events that are put back to charity. So the USPGA Tour, for instance, says that charity is the biggest winner on the PGA Tour. South Africa, too, the golfers have been extremely philanthropic. Ernie Els, Retief Huis, and Louis Oosthuizen, and they all have their little foundations. They all help with coaching. They all give towards the Golf Foundation, which is run by the Golf RSA, which is with Johan Rupert as the patron. So they do help youngsters to come into the game. But there's no getting away from the fact that it's an expensive game, and it has certain sort of Berlin Wall situations where you just can't afford to be a golfer. But I think if a young guy turns up, or a young girl, and she shows exceptional promise, she'll be helped and she'll be shown the way to the top.
Yes, as you describe, the profile of these 450,000 odd golfers is very elitist, very moneyed, very white. Would that be right?
It's changing rapidly, but certainly it's in the years since democracy in 94, it's changed amazingly, you know. And in my book, I talk about a player called Papwa Segolam, Indian player from Durban, who was horribly treated by apartheid. He had to get permits to play. He changed in his car. He once won an Natal Open, and he had to receive his trophy in the rain on the 18th green at Durban Country Club. It's most embarrassing when you go back on that. The reason given then was the apartheid laws and the liquor laws said that people of color weren't allowed in the clubhouse. And I think it's a stain on golf. The people of Durban Country Club should just have said, we're not doing this. He'll get his trophy won fair and square. There was a very good black player called Vincent Chabalala, who won the French Open, so he was good enough to win overseas, which is very difficult to do. So there are problems that did happen. We can't wipe away the past. I don't think it happens anymore. Golf these days, all clubs, if a person wants to join a club and can pay the membership fee. The membership fee is high because of the upkeep of the golf course, because, you know, it's a vast piece of land that requires a lot of equipment. But there are no barriers anymore. And we're slowly starting to see some really good young players coming from the previously disadvantaged group. One disappointment, though, is that a lot of development has gone on, a lot of coaching has gone on, and we still waiting for our Tiger Woods, because if that were to happen, then golf would really take off, because then there'd be that trailblazer, there'd be that hero. And I think that is the element that made the white golfers that good, because there was Bobby Locke, followed by Gary Player. And then everybody had a standard and somebody to follow. And it's taken a little bit long, but all over South Africa, we've dealt with the fallout of apartheid, and we still are.
If I'm not mistaken, Tiger Woods had very supportive parents. I think his mama always used to tell him he needed to wear red. So there was a lot of parental input. And in South Africa's case, it may not be the case unless guys and girls have got parents who play golf, you know, which presupposes a certain elitism. But just removing professional golf to an amateur golf or leisure golf, you know, recreational golf, it's very much the game of presidents, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, I think Cyril Ramaphosa plays golf. I mean, Donald Trump plays golf, you know, whatever we think about that. Yeah. Why is it said to be a game for presidents?
From what we hear, Donald Trump does nothing but play golf, which sort of upsets the electorate. Yeah, it is. Maybe that's the elite aspect. John F. Kennedy played golf quite often, and for him it was a pastime and a way to be away. Obama played golf, also not particularly well, but again, talks about just being out in the open, breathing fresh air and doing this ridiculous thing. Winston Churchill wasn't that fond of golf. He said, you know, you hit a little ball with an implement singularly unsuited to the job, you know. So typically Churchill just summed it up. But then the Japanese emperor played, the Japanese head of department played. I think it's the club thing that starts that. You know, it's a gathering of quite important people, gathering of wealthy people, and people who tend to have an influence. They then pull themselves together into a club to play their golf and to have their pubs and to have their friends around them. And that kind of heavyweight person, powerful person, is naturally attracted to that. And then the way the game is played, because it is expensive, because it takes a long time, and I think there are other aspects of golf, is that there was a great American player called Bobby Jones, and he was one of the top amateur players, probably the greatest amateur player ever. And Bobby Jones used to say that if you can play a round of golf with a man and enjoy his company, you can do business with him. So that is a very important aspect, because of the reasons people play golf, it then becomes a very good networking area where you can do business, you can work out whether you like somebody. For instance, if somebody's a cheat in life, they're going to be a cheat in golf. So it has a lot of those aspects, you know, and it's a very trying game. There's a word that was coined for it. It's called Liza Gog. And that stands for life is like a game of golf. And the reason that came about, obviously, because golf involves a lot of luck. It involves a lot of bad breaks. You can get bad breaks from good shots and good breaks from bad shots. It can be very frustrating. It can be very lonely. So it's like life, you know, that it really tests you.
Do you play golf?
Oh, yes, I do. You know, my background is obviously mostly rugby, and that's a numbers thing. So, but I always used to tease that rugby is my work and golf is my love. So as a young boy, I learned to play in the Karoo because my dad played on greens that were made of sand mixed with soil, and then you smooth the path to run the ball along. And so I've always been sort of fascinated by the game. It is something that fascinates me because it is the most ridiculous game when you break it down to its simple things, that you have this sort of club on the end of a long stick and a hard little ball that goes for miles, and you walk after it and then hit it again and hit it again and then put it into an impossibly small hole. If you had to try and explain that to somebody from Mars, they think you're completely stupid. Why would you do that and do that for 5 hours? No, but there's something that happens that it attracts you, and it takes only one good shot, one fabulous feeling shot that makes you feel like the master of the universe, and you go back again.
I guess so many sports, one could say, if somebody came from Mars, you think, why on earth are you doing this? It seems like such a silly pastime. But it does have an aspirational quality, and whether or not people talk politics on a golf course, who knows? But certainly they talk business, as you were describing. So it has a sort of aspirational quality. Is it growing in the business circles? I mean, it clearly takes way too much time. But is it something that people do a lot still in business?
Oh, yes, it is. There's still many business golf days, people sponsor days. It is a wonderful method to bring your clients together. So, for instance, we've had a book launch at a golf day because it worked for the client. He had a number of golfers as his clients, bought books as their presents for the day, and we do a little talk, and everybody loves it because they're gathering into a group that, where they feel comfortable and they're nice surroundings and things like that. So, yeah, no, it absolutely still happens. And then in pro golf, there's also the pro-am, professional amateur, which is very popular, where you combine amateurs with pros and each group gets a pro to play along. There's some prize money for the pros. The amateurs like it because they see a much better player. It keeps the pros busy because they get an appearance fee, and that happens always ahead of all tournaments. There's a pro-am, and people clamour to get places in pro-ams. You know, so if there's a Cape Open at Royal Cape, the pro-am on the day before is actually more important than the tournament itself, because that's what's important to the sponsor. And the reality of professional sport, whether it be golf or tennis or rugby, the sponsor, the money man, is the key person. The person who puts up the money dictates what happens. So, for instance, in golf or professional sports, the most powerful people are the TV broadcasters, the networks, the channels, because they put up the biggest sponsorship. So they absolutely dictate. And people in that field would even talk about product and not a sport. You've got to give me more product. So, for instance, you saw rugby get completely out of hand where the tournaments just became too big and unmanageable, but that's the TV companies were putting up millions of dollars and saying, you've got to give us more product. We need more matches to fill our channels. Golf is not that affected by that, because golf has a very strong and annually settled fixture list. Everybody knows when they're going to play. But it does have a pecking order. So the better you are as a professional golfer, the better it gets. And what I mean by that, you get into better tournaments because your ranking is quite high. But you start having courtesy cars and free accommodation, and people really pander to your every whim. When you're a struggling young golfer, that doesn't happen. You've got to wrestle your big bag of clubs through an airport, which is not easy. If you've ever been through an airport with a big bag, it's the worst thing on earth. You've got to hire taxis. You've got to find a caddy. You've got to find a way to pay for your caddy. So it's an absolutely an utter inspirational game. The better you are, the better it gets.
Lots of pros, quite literally, but lots of cons. But one of the pros of this book is that, you know, going back to the issue of the upcoming young golfers from all races and cultures, one of the pros of this book is that the funds, or the proceeds, I think part of the proceeds for it, will go towards the National Junior Development Centre. What is that, and what's its purpose?
Yeah, the background to that is that Johann Rupert was always keen that I do a golf book. But what he wanted was a book compiling the funny stories and the things that happen on golf courses. You know, for instance, there's a story about somebody who lost a golf ball in the rear end of a warthog that was running away. But then it got done by Dale Hayes. They pulled together all the little funny stories, all the humorous things. And a lot of that happens, and clever quips and things like that. And I felt that that had been done. But then in the back of my mind, I thought, but our golfers have been so good and have done so many things, you know, against the odds. We should pull it all together into one history, you know, the history in one place. And paper has memory. You can never wipe it out. Once it's written, it's there. I then proposed to Mr. Rupert that why don't I do a full-on history and pull it all together, and he approved. And the fund that he used is the National Junior Development Fund. So that's why we're trying to channel all the proceeds back to that so that we recover the costs and maybe a bit more. It's not the right time with COVID. We were expecting to do a lot better, but the history now stands. And I must add, I didn't want to do a dry history, you know, starting in the 1800s and ending now. I wanted to make it different, make it easy to read, have the kind of book that you could pick up and put down, read one story and then put it away. But at the same time, recognizing everybody that's made a contribution. If I have a sadness, it's the many people that are not even mentioned, you know, that because I didn't want that sort of chronological list of people, because a list changes every day. So I'm sad about that. There's some really outstanding players who are not mentioned, but all the good ones are in there. And it was a fascinating job. And it confirmed what I thought, that it should be in one place. And we should tell the story of South Africans that went out there and excelled. So just recently on our TV screens, we've been following a program called Chasing the Sun. It was about us winning the Rugby World Cup in 2019. Well, the golfers chased the sun long before the rugby players did, and in fact even ended up calling themselves Sunshine. So if I can give you an indication of that, Bobby Locke, when he first went overseas, would have gone by boat. There was a Scotsman called Sid Brewes who had an immense influence on our golf, lovely man, and he came second in a British Open. He went by boat, and we have a picture of him practicing his golf swing, hitting balls into a net on the deck of a boat. So Bobby did that, but his career was interrupted by the war. But Bobby Locke, by going and winning the British Open, he set the standard. And then there was Gary Player came soon after. And then all of them, Ernie Els, Retief Goos and Immelman, Schwartzel, Oosthuizen and Sally Little, they all say they were influenced by Locke and Player. Player, of course, being there's nobody more determined, nobody that has more desire than Gary Player. So he's an outstanding example.
He is indeed an outstanding example in so many senses. What's his famous line? The more I play, the luckier I get, etc. In fact, I think this book was brought out to coincide with his 85th birthday. Who is he inspiring now? Who are the young upcoming players? Who are we developing? The guys who could benefit from so much, not just from the ability to hit a ball, but from all the wonderful things about golf that you described earlier. Who are they, and is there a body that's actively encouraging them?
Yes, the way they do that is through Golf RSA, which is the amateurs, which is supported by the pros, and they have the Golf Development Board. So anybody that has talent who's picked up at a club, who's spotted, gets drawn into that, where they get very good coaching, they get help with equipment. And then, for instance, Ernie Els has a foundation where he helps players, and Retief Goosen does, and Louis Oosthuizen does. But it is the Golf Development Board run by a former professional who still teaches, Grant Hepburn, so that there's access to very good coaching. The reality of golf is that it's just you, the club, the ball, the hole, and your score on the board. There's no other way of manipulating golf. It's a very individual sport. If your score doesn't make the cut, you don't make the cut. So it's unforgiving in that sense. But again, as I said, it's like life. You know, you've got to be really good at something to really make it. But apart from all that, there is an enormous amount of support. And we've just seen that the next wave, I think, is on its way. We've been through a period where a young man called Chris Christian Bezuidenhout, has just won two tournaments in a row, which hasn't been done for a while. They both qualify as European titles. So already the stats in my book are changing. And there's a player called Wilco Nienaber, who is the world is agog at about how far he hits the ball and how much talent he has. Jaden Schaper's coming to the fore now. Really excellent young players. And then amongst the amateurs, I do have a section where I say whose name is written in the stars. And there's no way you can predict who's going to be the next. You know, you can have the most incredible amateur record and not make it as a pro, because some people can't cope with the loneliness. Some people can't cope with the travel. Some people hate being away from their families, can't cope with the setbacks. Others just keep going, like Gary Player. But there's a youngster called Casey Jarvis, who's just accomplished something that hasn't been done for a while. He won the South African Stroke Player, the South African Match Player in amateurs, and the Freddie Tate Trophy amongst the pros in the South African Open as the leading amateur. And that hasn't been done for more than 20 years, where one player won all three in the same year. And if I can just skip back on Freddie Tate, I mean, there's an indication of how our history works and how the British came. Freddie Tate was a Scotsman who fought in the Boer War and was killed in the Boer War near Kimberley at the Battle of Kuduzput. He was killed. He was Lieutenant Freddie Tate, but he was Britain's best amateur golfer, but came out to lead a Scottish squadron. And his name is enshrined on the Freddie Tate Cup, which is given to the leading amateur in the South African Open. And it still goes, you know. And there's a little shrine to Freddie Tate in Kimberley, because that's nearest to where he died. But he came from St. Andrews, you know, and did play a bit of golf out here, other than he was fighting a war in which he got killed. But now, if you look at the Freddie Tate Cup and you just see the lineup of names. So I'm wondering, is Casey Jarvis the next? There's a girl who's an outstanding player, Caitlin McNabb. She's gone the college route to America. That is one way to the top. You get a college scholarship in America. You hopefully learn a bit and get a degree, so you've got something to fall back on. But your golf is advanced because you play at a very high level. So is it Caitlin McNabb? We don't know. But what I'm waiting for is our next great woman player, because Sally Little is far and away the best. She's the only South African woman who won a major title. She won two, and the year after she won one of them, it became a major. She's the only South African woman, funny enough, to win on American soil. So I think it's time our girls stepped up. And there's a girl out of Swaziland, Nombula Dlamini. She's an outstanding player. She's a strong player. But again, as I said, all the talent in the world, all the promise means nothing if you can't put the score on the board.
We've been looking very much in hindsight. We've been looking backwards, but we're looking forward. You say, I think we've established that it's a very hungry, it's a very demanding game. I think the average size of a golf course is somewhere between 30 and 60 hectares, which is a whack of a lot of land, whack of a lot of water. What is the future of golf? You describe when you were a kid playing in sort of dusty avenues. Gary Player in your book also talks about, you know, when he was growing up, he would play on anything. Do you think that there could be a future where we reduce golf, we make it more accessible, we make it more of a 21st century game?
Yes, I think that people are definitely looking at that. One of the key things, of course, is water, because golf courses consume an immense amount of water. So a designer like Gary Player, Jack Nicklaus, they're already talking about water-friendly golf courses. And there's already a trend to get back from these enormous golf courses that take up so much. Of course, in the last 30, 40 years, the key trend to new golf courses was housing estates. So the golf course was the center of the housing estate, houses all around. And one of the reasons the course became quite big, because you need to put lots of houses around the golf course. So the more space on the golf course, the more space to build houses. You know, there's a trend away from that now, because people are saying, well, we can have the open space and the gardens and the bicycle paths. We don't need the golf course. The golf course costs too much money. So there's definitely an indication that the housing estates are going to end, although people who live on them swear by them. And again, if you can pay the money and that's your lifestyle, you're welcome to it, you know. But then you need to, again, it's what you can afford. I touched on it earlier that all over the world now, especially in America, their golf courses closing because they're not enough members in some places, or because they're too expensive, or because of urban creep, they get taken away. And then this move towards par three golf courses, in other words, much smaller golf courses where every hole is a par three rather than a four or a five, which makes it quicker, and easier to play, and you can, and more people can access it. The difficulty for the game is to continue being able to take it to the top level, where you play very hard and big golf courses like Augusta and Pebble Beach. So the game is very aware of it, and I've been told through my connections, you know, that the COVID and the realities of the world we live in is really starting to hit golf clubs. They really struggled through the pandemic. They're losing members. Funding's becoming very difficult. So I think you might also see clubs combining the golf. Also, in fact, in our city, Cape Town, some of the clubs are now being faced by very strong drives from activists who want the land to build houses on, and they make the point that the land just lies there fallow, and it could, and it's near the city, some of them, and Rondebosch, King David, Mowbray, and that land is being badly put to use. The counter argument, of course, is that it is open space, it is a green lung, and golf employs an enormous amount of people, you know, and I'm not just talking, a few people have caddies these days, but there are caddies. It's the staff in the clubs, the serving staff, the kitchen staff, the people in the shops. So that provides a lot of employment to thousands of people. And just recently, in the last 5 years, there have also been very dynamic young club managers come in who have understood that they're not in the business of golf. They're in the business of hospitality. And I think the one club, Royal Johannesburg in Kensington, their manager, Chris Bentley, will always tell you, this is not a golf course. This is a venue. So they're starting to use the venue for business meetings, for weddings. And it's a fantastic experience because the service is outstanding. The restaurants are very good. So they're making better use of their land. A lot of them have taken pockets of the land for building developments and have the finance to put back into the golf course. So a lot of that is happening. But I do predict there'll be a time we'll have even fewer golfers and fewer courses. And there is a saying that cycling is the new golf, because cycling points to the same demarcation. It points to the same demographic. It's people who are young and upwardly mobile, although some of the cyclists not that mobile, but when you get behind them in your car, young, wealthy, doing good jobs. The equipment they use is very expensive, so it links to golf. But why cycling is tending to become amongst a very important group, which is that group from late mid-20s up to into the 40s, instead of them becoming golfers, they're now becoming cyclists. And one of the key reasons they can afford the bicycles, which are very expensive, they can afford the upkeep, but they can go out on the road at 4:30 or 5 in the morning and be home for breakfast, having done a really important ride, really done their sport, seen their friends, and then been back with their family. So cycling is really taking hold. And the view is that the boom in cycling is causing a deflation of golf.
Well, perhaps your next book will be all about cycling. And certainly environmentally speaking, cycling is the way to go. Instead of hopping into your 4x4, you can cycle to work. So it has great potential from that point of view. Yes, I can see that it's a threatened sport. Nonetheless, it is a sport with a great history and hopefully some sort of future, because it's environmentally speaking, it can also benefit people to be out. And from what I understand, there's quite a lot of wildlife, never mind warthogs, trotting around on golf courses. I've seen golf courses with little springbok, and certainly I've seen a golf course in just outside Prince Albert that was bright orange because of all the flowers that were growing just in the dust. It was very quite a sight. But I think we should have the closing words from Gary Player. At 85, is he still playing? I know he's designed umpteen golf courses. What's his status at the moment?
Well, you know, Gary Player is the most incredible human being I've met. So you could dislike him because he's very outspoken and he's not short of a word. But when you take what he's done, he turned professional in 1953 without having an amateur career. He lost his mother very young, and I think that was an aspect that really drove him to be better. Of course, his brother became a very famous naturalist, Ian Player, who started the whole movement move to save the rhino. So obviously something in the family. But what Gary did and what he still does to this day is that whatever you do, you have to be the best. You have to be as good as you can be. So there you take a guy who's far away from the rest of the world, has to fly everywhere. He's smaller than the people he's up against. So he grabs a hold of fitness and he does it with absolute dedication. And he wins tournaments because he's got that absolute grit to win. And I once asked him about the secret of putting, and putting is a thing that really brings down a lot of golfers because they develop the yips. And I was asking, is there a secret? What do people do? And there are lots of views I was given. And Gary's answer was, when I said, what do you think of? He said, I don't think of missing. So he can be so focused that the thought of making a mistake doesn't enter his mind. And then 55, he wins the Egyptian Open. 58, he wins the British Open. Now at the age of 85, he turned 85 on the 1st of November. He's still going at it. He's still determined. For instance, he now doesn't play in tournaments. He's the honorary starter of the U.S. Masters at Augusta, where they used to have Arnold Palmer, Gary Nicklaus, all very prominent people who would hit the first shot. It's all very ceremonial, and off they go. So I got hold of him in America, in Philadelphia, which is quite interesting that WhatsApp is as clear as a bell from Philadelphia, but quite sort of hazy when you talk to your neighbor around the corner. And Gary said he'd come in from practicing. I said, Gary, 85, what are you practicing for? He said, because I want to outdrive Jack Nicklaus at the ceremonial start of the Masters. And that is what he is. He always sets goals. He always dedication. And I said to him, what is the key to your career? And he said, desire. It's how much you want it. And I think to round off, because I've known him very well, and because he sets such an example, the one thing he said to me in my one interview, what do you do now, Gary? How do you keep busy? And he said, you know, one of the things that motivates me is every day I try to be nice to somebody. So if I'm passing somebody on the golf course who's looking after the golf course, raking the bunkers, cutting the holes, I say to them, your course is looking very nice. And maybe that's a little lesson for everybody, you know, let's just be nice to everybody.
Random acts of kindness. Mm. Lovely. Mm. If anybody would like to be very nice to a friend of theirs and buy a copy of your book, how can they do that?
There are various ways. It's definitely in exclusive books, but you can also get it online from Books Direct. The corporates have contacted me and bought bulk where I give them a good price. But as I said, I would like to recover the funds. I would really like more funds to come back than what it costs, because it is an expensive book. And I'm not even embarrassed to say there hasn't been a South African sports book quite on this scale for a very long time, you know, full color, gold foil and things like that. As a final word too, I think my approach was not so much to tell the gory details. I felt it was important to not condemn or damn anyone, because there have been some awful incidents. We've talked about Papua Sagolam. I pay tribute to him in the book. But just so that what these people have done, this little group of South Africans who've done what our rugby players have done, who go out there and show that from the bottom end of Africa, you can be the best.